Hi, everyone, and welcome back to OTTB On Tap. I'm Neve.
And I'm Emily. Before we get to this week's episode, we have an exciting announcement. We're launching a Patreon channel starting at the end of October. If you'd like to learn more, please visit our newly launched website, www.otttbontap.com, to sign up for our newsletter. Side note, there are also some fun new features on the new website. You can leave comments or reviews and even send us a voice message. Please be sure to check it out. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. Hey, Neve, what's on tap this week?
I think it's safe to say that every equestrian we know right now has their eyes on the Olympics. And we thought this would be a great time to discuss some significant thoroughbreds that have found their way to the podium.
Historically, thoroughbreds have always played a big part in the Olympics, especially for eventing. But this year, there was only one full thoroughbred, right?
Yeah, so Shanae Lowings and Bold Venture were the Australian team's traveling reserve, and they had to step up in the last minute to help the team complete show jumping after Kevin McNabb retired on cross country day. They stepped in and had one rail and just 1.2 time falls for a good showing. The Australian team unfortunately finished 15th out of 16 teams after tacking on 200 points from Kevin's retirement on cross country and 20 points to substitute a new rider. The Olympic format and penalties and team situation is so incredibly confusing.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Because as you're reading that, that makes me think, did he finish cross country or did he retire on cross country? How do they even come up with those scores? I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's a penalty for not completing the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
Point is, if one of your three members can't complete their thing, you're screwed and you're not going to be in medal contention for sure. But so because there was only one thoroughbred competing in eventing, but Shanae's horse is a horse called Bold Venture, who, if that name sounds familiar, it's because there was a very famous American racehorse who won the Preakness and the Kentucky Derby in the 1930s by the same name. His Australian counterpoint raced three times and made $0. He's got the best jockey club name of all time, which was Hell on Wheels.
Oh my God.
And Shanae, she really liked the look of him and she purchased him for $1,000 sight unseen. He lived up to his jockey club name, giving Shanae a really tough time in the early days because he was so girthy and would just try to buck the saddle off. But before we get into too much about him, we're going to attach his confirmation photo of his listing from the track and talk about a near perfect confirmation photo. What do you think, Emily?
Yeah, when I didn't know who this horse was when I first saw the photo, and I was like, ooh, who's this one? It doesn't hurt that he's my favorite color, which is bright bay with white. Shocking, I know. But yeah, he's got a great expression to start with. Really lovely eye, and his ears are pricked looking forward. But he just has this really striking balance of all of his components throughout his body, which I think is very important. So he's got a big shoulder, but he's got a big hind end. His wither is above his hindquarters, which is always a plus. It looks like he has nice straight legs. He has lots of bone, but he's got a huge shoulder, great angles everywhere. I think something you point out, Neve, is maybe someone could say his neck is on the shorter side, but I tend to think when they have that longer, really setback wither, the way that this horse does, that actually means you're going to sit back a little bit further and their neck is going to feel plenty long when you're on them. But I would expect him to be a very powerful galloper and jumper the way he's put together. How about you?
Yeah, I remember when you were teaching me about how to analyze conformation, one of the things that always stuck out to me was evaluating the hind leg. And he has what you taught me to look for, which is that long Gascon muscle and a low set hock. Mm-hmm. And now knowing what to look for and what that ultimately means is that the horse is usually capable of a lot of power off the ground. And even if the horse was a tiny bit downhill, this one is not, but even if the horse was a little bit downhill, they would still have all the power needed to get over a big fence.
On top of that relationship of his stifle to his hock and the nice low set, very strong looking hock, he's got a very powerful hip angle. And then his shoulder has just a really lovely angle to itself, but also he's got that short upright humerus, that I look for. So coupled with the power off the ground, he should also be quite quick with his front legs and be able to have a lot of range of motion there, I would think.
Yeah, it might be cool to actually draw on this photo a couple of the things that we're talking about, because the way that this photo is lit, it's actually almost perfect. The highlight of the sun is like giving those angles already for us. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the open angle of his shoulder and the angle of his hip, I would say that from a confirmation standpoint is really about as perfect as it gets. He's really nice.
Yeah.
So we'll post that in the notes and see what you guys think. He is described, which I think a lot of other upper level thoroughbreds can be described this way, as being incredibly quirky. She said that he took to eventing really easily, naturally. He initially struggled with the dressage phase, but she now credits him as being so good-minded in dressage that it actually comes a lot easier for him than it did back then. And she can really rely on him to have a good dressage score, though she didn't get to feature that this year. His barn name is Bentley, and they made their FEI debut in 2018, and they haven't looked back since. It seems as though the sky's the limit for this pair. When I was researching this episode, I loved hearing about how genuinely connected Bentley is to Shanae. Apparently, he's incredibly particular about his needs, and if someone makes the wrong move or sneezes outside of his stall or something like that, they'll have to go get her and bring her back to put his rug on or give him meds or tend to him and things like that.
Going back to what you said about dressage, does that mean that not all thoroughbreds are crazy and some of them can be good at dressage?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it does.
Wow.
And I think that what you must want for an upper level horse that can do the dressage or just a pure dressage horse is a horse that's a very thinking type, which I think sometimes can let the riders down. I think thoroughbreds want to try so, so much for the rider. That's both a really good thing and can really hinder them sometimes. Sometimes they want to try too much or they anticipate too much. But I think when you find that nice balance of athleticism and try, then you've got a really good dressage horse.
Yeah. You then mentioned him being a bit quirky. And I think we can all relate to those really talented horses, whether they're upper level horses or just a horse that has a lot of talent and power and expression, that oftentimes you hear stories about them. Like we were talking about Brian's horse Bombino last week and how quirky he can be. And I know we've heard Boyd Martin talk about some of his top horses and how quirky they are. And I've certainly had that experience with my top OTTB. So I think it's definitely should be something you look for, maybe. Is this horse quirky? Maybe to make it to the top levels.
Yeah, I think so too.
Anyway, so on the heels of our interviews with both William Fox Pitt and Lucinda Green, which our lovely Neve was able to accomplish earlier this year, we are going to take this episode and take a little bit of a deeper look at a few of their favorite thoroughbreds that helped them to the top of their sport and also Olympic fame.
First up, we've got Lucinda Green's Regal Realm. This horse's backstory is really incredible, and I'm going to let Lucinda do most of the talking here, but when doing some research about him, found some very interesting facts. His nickname was Poncho, and he was a completely feral thoroughbred roaming the Australian outback for the first 2 years of his life. He was eventually rounded up, branded, castrated, and became a stock horse working cattle. He was a favorite of the riders for being nimble, sure on his feet, and he could work for 10 hours a day without an issue. And I think notably, when they came to look at him, he was already saddled from the full day's work when they went to go see him.
Always a good time to try a horse when it's very tired.
Right. It's worked its full day, yeah. He was originally sourced for Merv Bennett after the Montreal Olympics by Sir Alex Creswick, and within 3 years, Regal Realm would be the alternate to Regal Reign at the Olympics alternative venue in Fontainebleau, France, during the boycott of the Moscow Olympics, where Lucinda Green was also competing on her horse, Village Gossip, who we're going to get to in just a little bit. So as was pretty typical for back then, riders who traveled from a really far distance for international events were often forced to sell one or both of their horses to recover the expenses of the trip. And Lucinda had saved up enough money to look for another top horse.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
So, but it was 10,000 pounds at the time that she had. But all the Australian team horses were $20,000, except for Regal Realm, who was only $10,000 since he was the reserve. So Lucinda tried him, and without anything to jump, because there was nothing still set up, she found a couple of crowd barriers that were like 4 foot high, and she jumped him over them. And then he proceeded to take off with her into the Fountain Blue Forest. So we asked Lucinda about her favorite thoroughbreds throughout time, and here's what she had to say in her own words about Regal Realm.
I had two pure thoroughbreds. One won me the world championships, and his name was Regal Realm Australian, and I was given to believe he was by the Melbourne Cup winner Taunton. When I looked Taunton up years after Regal Realm had retired, he never won a Melbourne Cup. Anyhow, he was an absolutely brilliant horse who remained completely upside down in his neck. His ears were in my mouth all the
time. Yes, I just read about him.
Could not do dressage. Somehow managed to do a good enough dressage because lovely General Jack Burton from America was judging, and I had done something extraordinary in the winter when I'd come over to learned 3 days from Bert Dinemathy on a scholarship, and the snow came down and we couldn't get out in the car, so I went out on my feet and trudged through snow up to here to get to the Hamilton Centre and to have my lesson with Bert. And I don't think General Jack ever forgot that, and I honestly tell you he gave me way more marks than I should have had for a test done in a jumping saddle, because the horse couldn't take a dressage saddle with a very long outline, because if he came up, he came right up. I would say this horse, Regal Realm, had kissing spine because he never, ever basculed. He jumped everything boying up like that, straight across and down, and was utterly brilliant. So if he'd ever had an x-ray and they said he got kissing spines, can you imagine he would never have got anywhere?
Right.
Their journey started off pretty rough as he went horribly lame within a few weeks of coming home, which resulted in him getting joint injections in his feet. And at the time, that was something that really wasn't done, but now it's something that's just super commonplace, and he never had a bad step after that. She said he was a really difficult horse to get to know because he grew up in the outback, and he was never cuddly, and she could never get him to eat Polo mints. Her big successes were that she went on to win the World Championships, badminton, and the European Championships, and that sealed them a spot at the 1984 Olympics. They helped the team achieve a silver medal and a sixth individually. When I was researching this horse, I found a quote from Ian Stark where he said that he was like a terrier of the horse world, and while conformationally not being ideal, he was a brilliant cross-country horse and described him as a cage fighter. I think that's such a cool description for an event horse, or the type of horse you would want to be sitting on during that time, during the long format. She said her teammates always applauded with her understanding that some horses just have a unique way of going to perform well, and this case with his ears in her face. And rather than forcing his head down, she learned to adapt to his way, and he never let her down. At the end of his career, Lucinda was able to fly him back to his outback farm in Queensland to retire, and his whole life had come full circle. I think that's such a cool story.
Yeah, no, that really is a very cool story. He does not sound like he was an easy ride by any means, getting back to Quirky, right?
Yeah. Oh, and when we'll put pictures on social media, but when you see the pictures of him, every picture of him in dressage, he's got this really developed under neck muscle. He is, she said, jumping with his ears in her face. Like, he just jumped with this very strange, like there was no bascule. There was just no shape to him. It just flat jumping and just popping over everything. It looked amazing.
And she said, good thing they didn't x-ray backs back in those days, because who knows right. what you would find. That's all I'll say about that. Okay. So next we're going to revisit a piece of our interview with William Fox Pitt from earlier this year. Neve got the opportunity to ask him the same three questions she asked Lucinda, but here we will play the clip about one of his favorite thoroughbreds. Side note, before we play the clip, I wanted to let you all know that the videos for the full interviews will also be on our website for you to watch, so please be sure to check them out. It is just fascinating to hear two eventing legends and how they just light up when you ask them about thoroughbreds. So in William's clip, he talks first about his horse, Stunning. Stunning was an ex-race horse by Ring the Bell, and he actually started off his career with the great Mark Todd. And fun fact, when I rode at Kentucky in 1999, Mark Todd was riding Stunning there as well.
Oh.
Yes.
That's crazy.
So crazy. And then Mark Todd decided to retire for the first time of many times, and William got the horse, as he tells us in his clip. But really, William just racked up a lot of wins with this very special horse.
I've been very lucky to have ridden some thoroughbreds. I'm not really a thoroughbred horse size. I'm far too big for most thoroughbreds. I rode an amazing old horse that came to me from Mark Todd called Stunning. He wasn't actually very big. He was a New Zealand thoroughbred, and Toddy was retiring, or first time retiring, and handed him over to me and said, he's all yours. He was a funny little thing. He was a real toughy, real galloper, but he was stiff as a plank. But he took me around Rolex. He was fourth in Rolex. He won Blenheim, took me to the European Championships where he was sixth and won team gold. So he did a lot for me, but he's a real worker and a real quick horse. He won me the British Open at Gatcombe. He was actually the first horse ever to be inside the time. I don't have many claims to that because I'm not a fast rider, but I was on Stunning.
Something we should mention for those of you that don't know is that William is a very tall man. I think he's 6'5 or 6'6 you hear sometimes. So as he said, he's not really the typical size to be riding a thoroughbred, but he did have a couple that were very special, and Stunning really stood out to him. The other thing that he said was that Stunning helped get him back on the British team and really gave him a leg up in the early 2000s when he was short of horsepower. He had retired two of his top horses and really didn't know what was going to happen next. And so this little New Zealand thoroughbred gave him a massive boost when he really needed it. And then they went on to retire him, and he was a fox hunter, a schoolmaster. I think his groom ended up hunting him for years. And as he said, he started racing as a 2-year-old and he was still eventing at 19, which is pretty darn good.
Yeah, I think that's testimony to the work ethic of a thoroughbred, right? They don't want to be necessarily sitting in a field if they like to work. So
absolutely. And a lot of thoroughbreds we've talked about before get a bad rap for being difficult to keep sound or being injured. But when you have one that is tough as nails like that, there's really nothing that can break them. And they just keep going and going. So it sounds like he was one of those.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so cool hearing William talk about his physical limitations regarding horses, because you wouldn't necessarily think that he would. But I think a lot of people think, oh, he's this tall guy, it's so easy for him to ride all of these horses. But I think when you look at anyone like him and Boyd and the other riders that are really tall and lanky, they have such a tough job riding most horses, because they have that cantilever effect of their torso and their legs of being so lanky, that must be so much harder for them to ride and keep their center of gravity. So I really feel like they're working a lot harder sometimes, especially when they're riding something that is a little bit smaller. But I think William's point was, you don't turn down a good horse just because it's little.
Yeah. And the other thing about William is, he has quite a tall upper body as well. Like, he is not all leg like some riders that are tall are. And some of the old videos, my old VHS tapes I have, where you can watch him going around some of the big 3 days, and they talk about how he really had to learn how to use his body and how much more influential his body positioning and his shoulders and his, you know, not necessarily his weight, because he's for as tall as he is, He's
really lean.
He's quite lean. It's just that different balance of having so much up above the horse and how that can really put them off balance much more easily. So definitely a skill to learn. Advantage doesn't always go to the super tall.
The second horse of Lucinda's I want to talk about actually came before Regal Realm, and she credits this horse for teaching her how to ride a horse like Regal Realm. What she specifically said was she credits this horse into showing her how to ride a horse that doesn't want to be told what to do. And in her interview, she talks about the pressure she felt by getting this really talented and capable horse because she felt like she couldn't ride one side of him. So let's hear what Lucinda has to say about Village Gossip.
And the other one was a wonderful little horse who was incredibly difficult. Village Gossip, not bred particularly in the blue, but he had definitely a thoroughbred. He'd gone around Burley at 6 years old, and he was he just didn't pull up. He just went. And some very kind sponsors bought him for me for the princely sum, and it was a lot, £6,000 in those days. And of course, I thought, now I've got this lovely horse that's been bought for me, I must get him to go. And I had refusal after refusal. I couldn't get him to go anywhere I wanted him to go because he couldn't tell him. Mm-hmm. And one day I thought, I was in tears, I just could not get him. If I wanted to slow down for a combination, he'd stop. If I slowed down for a coffee, he'd stop. So I said, the next event we're going to at the weekend is an advanced event. It was pouring with rain. I'm just going to let you go as fast as you like. I'm not going to do anything. And he went flat out, way inside the time. Only won anywhere near the time. Won from a back position in the dressage, won that advanced event. And that was the way to ride him. Mm-hmm. You never took a pull. You had him on the contact all the time. Mm-hmm. But you didn't slow down. You moved your back, your body, and if he would go rocketing into a coffin and just go bang, and he was 1 minute inside the time at Badminton, and you could do nothing about it. And it came against me in the World Games in Kentucky when the humidity was 90%, and I had to let him go. He went round the steeplechase course, which was 5 or 5.5 minutes on that undulating ground, flat out, went round the cross country, and he got to the Serpent 3/4 of the way round, a sort of zigzag of fences over ditches, never forget it, and he fell. Mm. And he never fell. And he fell straight over the fence into this muddy water. But being him, he didn't just lie there, he got up. I got back on, totally covered in clay water, unrecognisable, and it was one time I felt this is the wrong sport to have as a team sport. I don't want to have to finish with this horse. And such was his courage. He picked himself up and jumped really well, 3-4 maybe fences to the finish. And as I cantered through the finish, my own chef to keep didn't recognise me. And I didn't run him in the show jumping because I felt he'd had to try his heart out. And he had a heart rate of 20 beats a minute, should be 40. And after that World Championships, it's strained his heart enough for him now to be normal. He had a beat of 40.
Wow.
And the next time he came out was Badminton, and he didn't feel right. He had a stop, and I didn't do any more with him for the rest of the year. So that was 6 months after Kentucky Worlds, and he came right back.
Wow.
And at 15, he was winning top-level events. He beat Mike Tango the first time that he had ever done a dressage test on the bit. And it was the first time I had realised that if I kept my hand still, he would go on the bit. If I tried to get him on the bit, and it was the first time, and it took me till he was 15 to get a dressage test out of him that beat Mike Tanger, who was pretty hot stuff with Bruce Davidson. So he was a remarkable, and both those horses were thoroughbred, and they were absolute geniuses.
It's also interesting hearing Lucinda talk about her shortcomings as a rider, because I think we all just think of her as this eventing god. And she said hilariously that it took her until he was 15 years old to where she could ride him in a dressage test on the bit. So I guess if you're feeling bad about your own riding, just remember that everyone's been there. What's really cool is that Lucinda, as much as being a great storyteller, she has also written several books. She's written a book about each of these horses individually. So if you want to find out more about them, you can find those on Amazon. And I think some of them might be out of print, but there's definitely a lot of copies available. So
very cool. So our last horse we're going to talk about in this section is William's second thoroughbred. And you may have heard of this one. His name was Park Lane Hawk. And Park Lane Hawk was quite a famous horse of William's. He won Burley in 2011. He was also won the four-star at Kentucky in 2012. And interestingly, he describes Park Lane Hawk as having a really good dressage temperament, so you could really ride him on the flat, but he had trouble with him. Sounds like he was a really big galloping type of horse, and he tended to jump a bit past his distances on show jumping. It sounds like he probably jumped a bit flat, and so he would have rails on him. Didn't seem to affect some of his wins, though, because he had a lot of major ones, as William will tell you about. His memory is really pretty impressive, but he ended up being his reserve horse for the Olympics and didn't actually get to ride him in the Olympics, which he sounds a bit regretful about, but still a really amazing horse. So roll the clip.
And then I had a lovely horse after that towards further on in my career called Park Lane Hawk. He was a New Zealand thoroughbred, and he was a lovely horse. He won Kentucky, he won Blenheim, and he won Burley, and he was third at Burley, and he was third at Badminton. He was a cool horse, and he was great because he had such a good temperament for the dressage. He had lovely movement, and I could really get the best out of him. He wasn't the best show jumper. Show jumper used to jump a little bit beyond his distances, a bit bold and big. He wasn't always nimble and clever enough, although he had an amazingly big, powerful jump. Wasn't always careful. So that was my only drawback, is why he didn't end up being my horse for the London Olympics. He was my reserve horse when we were trotting up in London. He was up waiting kind of 50 meters away in case my horse had not trotted up well. He was my backup, but he was a lovely horse, New Zealand thoroughbred.
That's interesting to hear his feeling of being disappointed that he didn't get to take that horse around London. You could tell he really thought so highly of him. And it's really sweet too. We'll post pictures, but I said to Emily when I was looking at one of the pictures of the two of them at a jog up, they're like the human and equine personification of each other. It's really sweet. They have the same kind of air about them and focus. And I don't know, there's something cool about the two of them together. You can tell that they had a nice bond. Before we finish up this episode, we just wanted to talk about a couple of other famous thoroughbreds throughout time that had made their way to the Olympics. One of my favorites was Touch of Class, a very diminutive mare, ridden famously by Joe Farges. Her jockey club name was Still a Spill. She was bred in Maryland and had six starts. She didn't make any money. They had considered making her a steeplechaser, but she was apparently really unruly to deal with. So they just decided that she could go on and have another career. She was passed around quite a bit when she was younger, and she never sold for more than $15,000 until Farges had a student named Debbie Connor who took her on and rode her through intermediate jumpers. She got injured and was sidelined for a while. So one of Joe's junior riders was looking for her next upper level mount, and they tried Kitty, as she was known in the barn, but they didn't buy her because she failed her pre-purchase exam. Now, I did look and I didn't find why she, quote, failed her pre-purchase exam, but I'm so curious. I might have to do a little more digging on that. But Joe, knowing how special she was, decided he was going to put together a syndicate for her to buy her, and did so even with the failed pre-purchase exam. And within a year, he had moved her up to Grand Prix and never looked back. Oh, and this is a great story about a tall rider and a small horse as well. So she's 16 hands, but she was not only 16 hands, but she was incredibly petite. She was fine-boned. She was short-coupled. She didn't have a long neck. And he's 6'2" and very lean and lanky. And when you see them together and you see her next to these jumps that are 5 foot tall and 6 feet wide, you're like, that doesn't even seem possible. But she just sprung off the ground with just such power and quickness and handiness. It was really incredible to watch. But when she was in the 1984 Olympics, of the 91 jumps that she faced during that time, she only ever had one rail down. And she ended up being named the first non-human U.S. Olympic Committee's female athlete of the year, which I think
that's
is
wild.
So cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she won gold at the 1984 Olympics. She won six Grand Prix, second and third and 14 others. She won many Nations Cup team titles, and she wound up in first place in the World U.S. East Coast League standing. She also went on to have a really nice breeding career and was inducted into the Show Jumping Hall of Fame in 2000. So really cool mare. I watched her video from the 1984 Olympics today where it was both American riders in first and second place. The second rider was on a horse named Abdullah, a big gray horse that was known for being... Yes, thank you. And so they knew going in that they were probably going to be first and second, but they didn't really know who was going to win it. And Conrad went in first and had two or three rails. And I think Joe could afford to have one rail when he went in, and he jumped clean. And the mare was just unbelievable. It like will make all your hair stand up to watch it. It's very cool.
Not bad for a tiny little thoroughbred mare.
Oh, and it was so funny when I was reading about her, because they were saying that she always wanted to cross canter. She never wanted to trot. I feel like again, coming back to the quirky thing, like sometimes that perfect personality and perfect way of going does not equal upper level.
So I have the opposite of that. And then before we get to my very favorite one, but when I was a kid, I remember hearing stories about this horse named Keen. And Keen was a giant thoroughbred. They said he was about 17'3", really big, heavy boned. And he never raced, I think probably because he was so huge. And he was brought along by a dressage rider named Hilda Gurney. And they ended up actually helping the U.S. dressage team win the team bronze medal over the Soviet Union at the Montreal Olympics, which was a big deal. The U.S. really, I think, has always, I don't want to say struggled, but we've never been a sure thing at the top levels of international dressage. So the fact that Hilda Gurney was able to take this giant off-track thoroughbred and accomplish Olympic medals back in the 80s is just such a really cool feat. And the other thing is that this horse helped popularize dressage as a household name and sport when it wasn't really well known in the U.S. And it helped a lot of young riders to start riding dressage and riding in general. And the USDF also inducted him into the Hall of Fame in 1997.
We'll post some pictures of him. He looked very cool. I don't remember him that well. I do remember the name. We forgot how to podcast. We took 1 week off because there were five Tuesdays in July, and we took 1 week off, and look what happened. So
we would be remiss if we did not talk about one of the most famous, not only thoroughbreds, but most famous not only show jumpers, but probably one of the most famous American Olympic horses of all time. Who do you think we're talking about, Neve?
Jem Twist.
Thank you.
Am I partial now because I have a horse named Jem? I don't know. Maybe, but I'm just kidding. So he was really a horse that was prolific at the time where we were little horse crazy girls. If you watched any sport of horses back in that era, you remember this big gray horse.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember that I went to the Festival Champions at the USET at Gladstone, and Greg Best and Jem Twist were competing there. And I was so nervous, but I think I made my mom ask him for an autograph afterwards. And he signed my program, said all the best.
Oh my God.
Greg Best. I'll have to see if I still have that somewhere. But yeah, that was definitely a very special moment to me. Not only getting to see my very first experience seeing horses jump a Grand Prix course, but at such a special venue as the United States Equestrian Team headquarters in Gladstone, New Jersey. But this big gray horse was just such a presence. There are so many iconic photos of him and his rider, Greg Best. And then he even went on, though, to two additional top Grand Prix riders, Leslie Howard and Laura Chapeau, and just became such a top icon of the sport. And He was a full thoroughbred. Nowadays, I don't think he's with us any longer. However, he was cloned 3 times, and there are 3 breeding stallions that were cloned from him. And what's really also interesting is that they stand in Germany, not the U.S., and I'm interested to hear more about that story at some point.
I'd love to go down a cloning rabbit hole situation because during the time that they started cloning them, apparently it was all very secret. Because I'm sure at the time that they were doing it, probably sounded like some weird science.
It was.
So people our age can remember when they first trotted out those 2 sheep or whatever, where they're like, look, we did it. We cloned something. And everybody was like, I don't know if you should be doing that.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like a great idea.
I remember I read like a newspaper article. This is how long ago it was, about one of his clones. And I just remember I didn't know much about, I still don't know much about horse genetics and color and stuff, but I thought it was very interesting that his clone was chestnut, not gray. Knowing now what I do is that I think chestnut and gray have very similar, going to use the wrong word here, but genes or characteristic traits. And also, and I'm not sure which clone this was, but I remember in that article, they said that they weren't going to train and compete this horse. And I thought that was really odd. But since the purpose was for just carrying the genetics on, there probably was some worry that what if the clone didn't do as well?
And also what I thought was interesting when we were researching this episode was finding out that the clones were 15-2 and he was like 16-2, 16-3.
He's quite a big horse, I think.
Yeah. And so I thought it was interesting that they cloned him and they have these like little miniature versions of him. But maybe that's what happens when you clone. I don't know. Again, more research will have to be done.
Maybe that's why the polo horses are cloned. So they're smaller.
Yeah.
I'm totally making that up. But I do know that they clone polo horses. I know that.
Oh, I was looking through his lineage and they showed one of the horses really far back in his lineage, which was a very famous gray stallion. I think his name was Le Saucy or something like that. And he was one of the only gray foundation thoroughbreds from that era. And they were saying that it was very unusual for that gray gene to be carried so far down the line. And one of the things that I read was they were saying that the gray gene only counts for 3% of thoroughbreds in modern day breeding. And I was like, wow, because it seems like there's more than 3%, but I guess that maybe that is accurate. I don't know.
I'm looking up his breeding now. So he was not registered as Gem Twist. He was registered as Icy Twist, which is interesting, by Good Twist out of Coldly Noble, who is by Noble J. So we'll post his pedigree as well, along with on our social media, along with that. I hope you guys learned a lot.
Anyways, obviously there are tons of other full thoroughbreds that have made their way to the top level of the sport. We had quite a bit of fun researching this episode, but if you have any favorites that you like, please comment on our post with their names so we can look into them.
I was going to also say what I like about this. One of the few things is that all of these are horses that are not eventers. Really interesting, the prevalence of the thoroughbred in show jumping and even in dressage back in the 80s, which nowadays you wouldn't see as many thoroughbreds at the Grand Prix level of dressage. There are some, and there are some very nice ones, but pretty cool.
Yeah, I think in one of the articles that I read, Joe Farges was quoted as saying something along the lines of, no matter what they've done at the track, they're so athletic and light on their feet and quick thinkers. And that's what he really liked about them. We hope you liked our little recap on thoroughbreds at the top levels in the Olympics. The Olympics are still going on, obviously, and everyone's having fun. Nobody more than Snoop Dogg. What? He's there and he's having the best time.
No, everyone was very excited to see Snoop Dogg in a shad belly and breeches and a helmet. But did they get him on a horse? I haven't seen it.
I think he called up Martha to come over and hang out with him because he's allegedly afraid of horses.
But yeah, Martha looked great in her dressage outfit.
She rides, though, too.
Yeah, I know. Or I didn't know that. I learned that very recently. But yeah, I thought that was really hysterical.
Yeah, the two of them. They just need like their own like offshoot. Like, why isn't NBC just hiring them to do all of the commentary?
Maybe we can ask them to be on the podcast next.
That's not a bad idea, actually. Coming up next week, we are going to be returning to our roots of our RRP participants. So we're going to be back on track with that, catching up with those women. They've been doing a lot, so we're excited to see what they've been up to.
I think that we should interview Snoop Dogg and Martha Stewart, then you have to drop us a comment.
Yeah.
Like and share.
Right.
Snoop Dogg, hashtag OTTB on tap, Snoop Dogg interview.
I would love it so much. My whole life would be complete if I could do that.
We wouldn't be able to talk. We'd be worthless.
Yeah. Well,
all right. Anyway.
Listen, if I can interview William and Lucinda, I feel like,
you can interview
just giggle the whole time. Yeah. Yeah. Why not? If you like what you heard today, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find our podcast when you do that. You can follow OTTB on tap on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and contact us with interview candidates and topic suggestions at OTTBontap.com. We love hearing from you.
And send us a voice message. We can't wait to hear your voices.
Oh my God. Yes.